Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comte-usa.com. That's comte-usa.com.
This week on Meatin' 3, we head into the second part of our mini-series on global trade, where we talk about all things sweet, from chocolate and sugarcane to the cultural festival that accompanied the growth of the date industry in the U.S.
They're using this romance and fantasy to say dates are exotic and you should consume them.
I like to think of the food that we eat as archaeological artifacts, in part because the history of humanity is in the stands in your produce market.
It's not like other foods. We have very personal feelings about chocolate.
Tune in to Meatin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Kara Warren, and today on the show we have Nick Bain, head cheesemonger at the Fine Cheese Company in Bath, England, and he is also the 2015 Cheesemonger Invitational winner, as long as a UK competitor in the Concours Mondial du Meilleur Fromager. For our listeners out there, this is the international competition for cheesemongers in France. So I tried to listen hard on how to pronounce that the best I could. Maybe Nick will say it better. But Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. 6 years after my first time on it, more or less, which seems crazy because it doesn't feel like 6 years. My French is terrible. So the Concours Mondial du Meilleur Fromager is as close as I can get. And goodness knows if that's any good.
Which is actually a really good sign. Compare my version to your version. Your standards are very high. That sounded great. That was very good.
Well, they are just across the channel. So I have to be nice to them.
Yeah, I was just going to say, are you on the same time zone as well with parts of certain parts of France? Is it?
Think so. No, actually, pardon me.
Maybe not.
Because when we went over there to compete, we were an hour ahead. So no, there's a great big channel that divides us, and then you're in Europe and things change over.
So you have different time zones then. Just a small segue, because I was like, maybe he's on the same time zone as Normandy. But anyway, that's a side note. You were a cheesemonger in the States for a long period of time. And the reason I invited you on Cutting the Curd today was I wanted to get your comparisons and your knowledge about cheesemongering in Europe, because I feel like there could be some differences. What do you say to that?
I would agree. You know, I moved out to the UK almost exactly 3 years ago, on the 21st of January, 2018. And I, like you said, I've been working in cheese in the US for a good long time. I've been in the industry on and off for the past dozen years now, and completely full time since 2013. And in particular, I was really used to a New York influenced, Brooklyn influenced American way of doing things. And it's a bit different out here. There's a longer history to cheesemongering in the United Kingdom. There's obviously been a longer existence of cheese making on this island, certainly in the sense of Western European influenced cheese making and cheese selling. So as a result, there are a lot of cheesemongers who came before me, and it really influences how things are done here.
Now, I would imagine you're working with European cheeses also that you never had the chance to work with before in the U.S. What's that like?
Oh, gosh, it's amazing. Let me tell you.
I'm very jealous, by the way.
Running into either raw milk versions of pasteurized stuff I had in the U.S. or just things I'm simply not able to get a hold of in the U.S., new British cheeses that are absolutely stunning that can't be exported to the U.S. because of the 60-day pasteurization, raw milk rules, is just fantastic. There are depths of flavor I hadn't run into before in soft cheeses. Even if you take something as ubiquitous as, say, Brie de Meaux, well, in the United States we have Fromage de Meaux, the pasteurized version, but here we have the raw milk version of Brie de Meaux, and the one we carry in the shop in particular is from Danger, which is just a fantastic hands-on producer. And there's just a certain lingering otherness that you can experience with that just doesn't quite come through if I had to compare. So yeah, it's been really, really fulfilling and wonderful just to start to both tick some cheeses off of that bucket list you start to create when you've been a cheesemonger for a long time, but also just to come into contact with cheeses and flavors that I hadn't been able to quite run into in the U.S.
So I wonder then, do you feel at least that the customers in Europe have a different sort of palate than the ones that are shopping in the U.S.?
There's a different sort of palate, but there's also something culturally entirely different. I can speak primarily to the British customer. And for them, for older British customers, there's a lot of association with territorials and growing up. So if you grew up in Yorkshire, you grew up with Wensleydales. If you grew up in Lancashire, you grew up with different ages of Lancashire, be it what they call creamy, which is young Lancashire, or tasty, which is young to middle-aged Lancashire, and so on and so forth. And you get very, very particular about that. And there are actually regional loyalties to these sort of things. I don't see that as much from American customers, where a Wisconsinite might say, well, you know, it's really only Wisconsin cheddars that I have, or a Vermonter will be similar. We have our preferences, but it's less informed by that sort of thing. In general, I do find a slightly more cheese educated, or at least cheese positive vibe from the customers out here. And I think that's partly familiarity. Cheese is such a staple part of the diet of Brits. Even if it's on the more kind of supermarket side or block cheddar side, it's such a part of what everyone grows up eating here. As opposed to the United States, where I think we run into kind of younger and milder things as we grow up that are sort of incidental. So meant with zero offense to the wonderful cheesemakers who are making any of these things, but, you know, string cheese or Monterey Jack or American singles, you know, we're used to that. And that sort of builds our palates as we grow up. And no offense to those, because many of us who grew up on that sort of thing ended up being cheesemongers. You know, I ate plenty of easy cheese in university. But I think it's a bit more of an integral thing out here. And the benefit of that is that British customers have really helped us through some of the tough times of the pandemic when it comes to retail, because cheese is such a staple part of the British diet. So it acts as both comfort and it acts as nutrition out here. And so people continue to purchase it.
Oh, wow. So actually, in a little segue, because of COVID and the fine cheese company, what kind of retail rules have you guys been following? Is there a limit to the amount of customers in the store, or is it, can you actually describe the fine cheese company counter for us as well, just to kind of give the listeners an impression of what it is and what it's like?
Absolutely. Well, I wish you all could just come and visit me.
Me too, one day.
Excluding that, So if you walk into the shop where I work, so first of all, I should mention, so I'm the head cheesemonger for our original shop in the beautiful UNESCO World Heritage Protected City of Bath, which is gorgeous. And we are in an old Georgian building, at least 250 years old. And if you walk inside, through the window, you will see two cases of small format cheeses. One half are my cow side, the other half are my goat, sheep, and mixed milk side. And then you walk in, there is a lovely marble counter on which we work. And behind me are about 120 or so cheeses on a beautiful shelving unit. So these wooden shelves that are refrigerated and just display the cheeses wonderfully. So that's my shop there. And we're filled with all of the crackers we make, and chutneys and fruit for cheese, all of which we export to the US as well. I have my standing charcuterie case with all kinds of beautiful European and also British charcuterie in it. And in terms of what we have to do with customers right now, we made the determination very early on to continue the retail experience for customers, but make sure it's a safe one, both for them and for us. So our current policy is one household at a time in the shop. Spatially, we probably could do one more, but we only have one door out of which people can enter or exit. So we want to keep that clear. So right now it is a very personalized shopping experience. We've adapted somewhat over the past few months. So I have a couple of fantastic cheesemakers in the shop with me, my team of Roberto and Alice. And at any given point, any one of us, if we see someone queuing outside, will pop out the door and see if we can start to prepare their order for them or start to describe cheeses for them out the door to find out what they'd like or even bring them little samples. So we're cheesemongering sometimes without that case right there with us or without all of our cheeses in front of us. We have our beautiful ambient display, but you know, we can't have people sampling directly off of that. So we have screens in front of that now. So we're really sampling exclusively off the tip of the knife, which is pretty traditional for the United Kingdom, which we don't do in the US at all, do we? We
have right. I was going to say, that's very different. that's cool.
I had to get used to that a bit. My very first mentor in cheese in the US, Chantal Girard at the Dean and DeLuca counter, used to do that. And her practice was informed off of decades of doing this at Artisanal and Picheline and also in France where it's off of the knife tip. And I had to get used to that because I wasn't comfortable with that at first. But now it is my favorite thing to do. And of course, if anyone makes contact with the knife or between everything, we sanitize heavily, we wash heavily, which we were doing anyway before the COVID era. I think if you are a cheesemonger with good sanitary practices, then you're actually very well set for this pandemic in which we find ourselves, because you're already washing down, you're already keeping strict charts of everything you do, you're already keeping every temperature log, making sure you do rotational sanitizing, rotational cleaning. So we find ourselves in a really good place with that. And what's been really wonderful is that on and off, depending on the lockdown situations, the people of Bath have continued to come into our shop and support us, which helps us, helps the independent businesses around us. It's been really fulfilling, even when business is down.
That's good. I like to hear that. And in terms of, I was going to say, verbiage and slang, have you? Because for some reason in my mind, I have this idea that in the UK, there's like a bunch of words for cheesemongering, for cheese people to like, they have to kind of reconstruct the conversation. But that may not be true. This is just in my movie magic mind. Was there a bunch of new slang and verbiage that you had to like learn on the job?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm a little lucky in that I went to graduate school in Scotland. So I'm already used to the thickest version of any UK dialect there is and the most slang. There are a couple things. So first of all, you have to get used to weight conversions. So you don't work off of quarter pounds or pounds or any of that anymore. You're working off of kilos. You're working metric. And it's not a difficult thing to do. And I already knew it to a small degree, but you really have to get used to cutting, say, 100 grams is the standard small cut people want rather than the standard small cut in the US of quarter pound.
Or half a pound for some counters, which I like. I like that.
Yeah, lucky counters. That's us for Christmas, is 250 grams, which is around the
really?
Same amount.
Really? Oh, yeah, wow. Absolutely. I like that move. Okay.
It's a nice little bit to sling there. So, yeah, there's that. There are things, there are certain, I suppose, terms people use about specific cheese, about the age mark. So, like we said, someone walks in, do you have a creamy Lancashire? Well, Kirkham's Lancashire, which is a beautiful, fluffy, raw milk heritage cheese from Lancashire, I think has a very fluffy, rich texture to it. But when they say creamy Lancashire, for example, they specifically mean a very, very young Lancashire of the age designated as creamy, which I don't have. So I find them something similar. Things like that. A lot of people ask for a sliver of cheese. Now, to my American ears, it sounds like a slither, like there's some sort of snake in the cheese. It's not the case. It's just a sliver, just, you know, a small bit, but things like that. A lot of use of the word truckle as opposed to wheel, I think.
Yeah, truckle. They've tried to use truckle at the U.S. counters. I feel like there's Flory's truckle.
There is Flory's truckle, which helps a lot.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, so I think a lot of what you must be so excited about, and I've seen it in some of your writing, is you mention origins of cheeses and like extreme history of these cheeses. That must be so thrilling to you to be in the land and like to be almost researching up close all of these cheeses, all the Shire cheeses, you know, that come up. The true homeland of cheddar for you, I saw in your writing. How does that feel to be getting such a close look at these cheeses?
So you know me, and I'm a huge history nerd and cheese nerd.
I couldn't tell. I had no idea.
We've talked to the nth degree. And so, yes, for me, it's incredible. You know, I live in Bristol, and I work in Bath in Somerset. And so all around me are the Mendip Hills, deep into which there's the Cheddar Gorge, where there's been cheese making, in this case, in a small Roman city for at least the last 2,000 years, in some degree, and probably longer, depending on what Celtic yoghurty sort of things are being made before. Being somewhere with this much history just gets me going. It inspires me. It's even small bits of being nearer to the land than I was before. You know, when you live somewhere like San Francisco, New York City, it's wonderful because you have these great cheese counters. But what we frequently miss because of the distance is the connection to where the cheese is actually made. I remember I was in Switzerland, in Le Gruyere. AOP had brought me out there to see dairying. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be amazing to live in a small city right next to the countryside and right next to where all of the cheesemakers I work with are. And I've managed to find that here in the UK, in Bristol and in Bath, because, you know, if I drive for 30 minutes, suddenly I'm at Westcombe Dairy. A little farther than that, I'm at Keynes. You know, if I'm on a bus for 10 minutes, I'm suddenly at Bath Soft Cheese. And forget the bus, my bike commute that takes me from Bristol to Bath every day takes me right by both their high and their low pastures. So the ones down by the canal and their beautiful ones on the hillside with a mansion on top. I mean, it's where I want to be. So it connects me with that, which is wonderful. And at the same time, there is this active and revolutionary wave of young cheesemakers making new cheeses, which for me is tremendously exciting.
Oh my. Nick, it sounds like you got a lot going on there. I'm actually going to ask you about some local cheeses when we get back. I want to take a quick break. Okay, listeners, this is Cutting the Curd with Nick Bain, and we will be right back.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin in the USA. Comté is a raw milk, cooked, pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Comté within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Comté. Comté takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineurs on average, each wheel of Comté is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Comté is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Comté is unique. Learn more about Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. I am your host, Kara Warren, and today on the show, I have Nick Bain. He is head cheesemonger of the Fine Cheese Company in Bath, England, but he is also an excellent Instagrammer. His handle is @thecheesemason, and I feel like I'm always learning through you, Nick, especially nowadays when everything is kind of, you're isolated. It's like I'm traveling over to Europe when I look at your Instagram. How do you do that? No, but it's great.
How do I do what?
I guess you just find the passion and then you go into the history of it. It looks like for each cheese, you know. I love that about you.
When you're so passionate about a thing, as both you and I, and I think the vast majority of our cheesemongering colleagues are, it's all about translating that cheese to I guess the outer world in some way. So on the counter, we're doing that for the customer, right? We're describing it to them. We're that last step between the farm itself and the customer's mouth. And so I look at Instagram as that. And I definitely used to be more on the hashtag cheese porn side of Instagram, and I still veer that way sometimes. And I definitely have a bit of a showy
it has some entertainment value, though. It's good. And yeah. I feel like yours is educational and the pictures are beautiful. And it always makes me think of you when I see those posts. So I'm glad you're doing them.
I appreciate that. You know, I've tried over the last, particularly over the last 2 years, to add a bit more of the educational side into there and a bit more of the descriptive side, to talk about flavor, to talk about texture, to talk about molds, to talk about the background of the cheese, rather than just look at this beautiful, dripping, gorgeous cheese that I wish I could smear all over my mouth. And because that's the entry point, right? But then there's so much to each one. I respect and to a degree revere the heck out of all of these cheesemakers, and all I want is just to show off what beautiful things they've made in the finest light.
So are you working with more cheesemakers in the UK directly now, or do you have a local connection with a lot of these cheesemakers now?
Yes, very much so. So in the US, for context, I was working at small independent cheese shops primarily. Starting with Bedford and moving on from there, Meckleburg's, Foster Sundry, all of that, which is great. But the difference for me right now is I work for the Fine Cheese Company, and I work specifically for the retail arm of that. So first as the manager of the shop in London, and then here. What's great about this company is not only are we retail, we are an importer of European cheeses and products to the UK. We're an export of British artisanal cheese and our own crackers and chutneys and whatnot to the rest of the world. And we're a wholesaler for the UK as well. So we have all these different hats. And what's amazing about these different hats is that it connects you even more to the producers. So for instance, we hand select cheddar with Westcombe Dairy, and I've been lucky enough to be part of that. I've gone on plenty of producer visits, both to talk about their cheeses and select. which is wonderful. I get to see, again, Tom Calvert of Westcombe, or I get to see Tim Homewood or Angela come into my shop every week to drop off some cheeses. I mean, it's really, really great to have a direct and personal connection with the people who make your cheese and anything else, really.
And when you mean selecting, because I just want to, in case we have some newbies to the cheese world here listening, you mean, are you getting to taste different wheels back to back? Like a vertical tasting? Yeah.
Literally. So sometimes you'll taste a couple of consecutive days. Our particular approach for a selection with Westcombe, for example, is we're not selecting a specific profile. What we look for is complexity, the ability, either if the cheese is younger, for it to develop even more complexity. So we're looking for either potential, or we're looking for realized potential, something with a long finish, something that has the characteristic Westcombe kind of cooked fruit with sort of toasted hazelnut with a balanced acidity, nothing that's burning too much, but something that's going to last and make someone's jaw drop. Same thing if I'm going up to visit Leicestershire Handmade Cheese, Spark and Home Farm, and taste through some of their Red Leicesters. We're looking kind of for what they're doing and for their input about what they're doing and our input towards what they're doing to help develop things further and further. There are some new cheeses we're working with and really some new ones that have emerged in the last year as a response to the pandemic and as a response to milk surplus. And so our ability to have a dialogue with cheesemakers is really to our benefit as they try to find what is going to sell well and what's really going to show off their milk.
Was it in your article then that I read that a cheesemaker used to make soft cheeses, but instead he turned to making aged cheeses?
Well, so he still makes the soft cheese.
And he's still making the soft cheese. Okay.
Yeah, so there are a few examples of this. So in this case, we're talking about Dave Jowett of Kingstone Dairy in Chedworth in Gloucestershire, who makes the stunning spruce-bound Rural Right and washed rind Evenlid. But as a response to the pandemic, you know, he was left with more milk than he could move into the market because he had soft cheeses and all these restaurants weren't taking them anymore because they closed. And so as a response to that, he's developed several new firm cheeses, including Ashcombe, which is a Morbier style, and also including a Tom style and including a new territorial based on kind of older Gloucestershire recipes. Similarly, a cheesemaker who people in the US will know, actually, Juliana Sedley, who makes a cheese called Baronet. She used to work for Capriol. And in fact, if you've had Juliana from Capriol, that cheese is named after her. She has started making the first of its kind that I've ever seen, an ash-ripened Jersey cow's milk cheese. So looking at it, you'd think Seltzer Share, but it's Jersey cow and it's golden and it's utterly unique. And several other, you know, cheesemakers are doing this. There's one up in Cumbria, Martin Gott, who is just an incredible raw milk cheesemaker. And he makes a cheese called St. James, which is a washed rind raw sheep's milk cheese from his own herd. And he started really producing a firm one called Crookwheel, which some people would liken to Manchego. I wouldn't. I think it's utterly unique taste of his own herd, but kind of in that firm raw sheep's milk natural rind category. And then another cheesemaker went out of business. They make Innis Log and Innis Brick, and he bought their goats, and he has started to make a firm goat's milk cheese called Holbrook, and that tastes phenomenal. So you see people responding to this adversity, which I think is really inspiring. And for me, again, as a history nerd, you know, we hear all about, you read your cheese books and you hear all about the idea of cheese evolving as a response to the circumstances around it culturally. And this is an example of that. This is literally an example of what we hear them talking about from centuries ago. This is a response. And I think it's fascinating and, of course, delicious.
You know, Nick, you are so passionate now about UK cheeses and culture. I'm curious if you're going to write a book one day, or at least you're going to keep writing articles, I think. I hope that continues. And then I wonder, will you ever return to the U.S. to sell cheese?
Well, I can answer those in two parts. So I don't know if I'll ever write a book. I'm so ADHD. I don't know if I could put my mind together for that long. I will tell you what I've really been loving reading is the recent book by Ned Palmer, A Cheesemonger's History of the British Isles. It is absolutely fantastic and utterly readable, and I think summates a lot of the historical points I've kind of referenced. But in a really digestible way, and addresses some of the new British cheeses as well. You know, books like that, I mean, Reinventing the Wheel, et cetera, those make me quite passionate for this sort of thing. So I don't know, everyone writes better than me, but I'll certainly keep writing articles. I do have a little research project up my sleeve that I don't want to go entirely into, but it does involve the pandemic being over and my ability to travel into the mountains of Eastern Europe and kind of Alan Lomax my way through disappearing cheeses and small villages there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. As for America, well, yeah. I'll tell you, I don't really have any plans to come back to the U.S. I love it out here. My wife loves it out here. I like that we are both closer to my in-laws in Israel. I don't like being so far away from my family and friends. I do like that I'm really close to the rest of Europe. So even though Brexit has happened, I still have a lot of access to that, to find out more and learn more and see more of the world. And I really enjoy that. For me, I think it'll have to be continuing to keep some American cheese on my shelves. That's probably going to be what it's...
That's about it for now. Which ones are you getting a chance to sell? Because I only know a few that I but what are you selling at your counter American wise?
Right now, today, I don't have any on my shelf right now. But I do periodically have some. So it's quite difficult. A lot of customers ask the question, well, aren't there any good cheeses in the U.S.? Well, I've been to the U.S. and I haven't had any good cheese. Oh, America, where they have those flat square cheeses. And I have to kind of dispel the myth. There's no real trade agreement for us exporting artisanal cheese in any sort of efficient way, which would make it hard. But luckily, Jason Donnelly of the American Cheese Company, who also heads up our export team, has made it easy to bring American cheeses into the United Kingdom. And so in the past year, for example, I've had Rogue River Blue on my shelf. Lucky me.
Very lucky.
I've had some really stunning Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I had some Tarentaise. I had some Griffin. I had Thomasville Tom. So good examples of raw milk American cheeses in that case, and really good examples of artisanal American cheese that really show off what we can do. Because the most I can do otherwise is explain to people, well, if you know, you go to the United States, go to such and such and such in New York, go to such and such and such in Seattle, go to this place in Des Moines, go to this place in Los Angeles, which is fine, but ultimately they'll most likely forget about it once they go to the U.S. And then, I don't know, walk into somewhere they shouldn't and take out some terrible cheese.
And then they have cheese failure. No!
Right, exactly. I mean, like, when I visited Kiev, the first place I walked into was a Dutch cheese shop. And there was a bunch of flavored Gouda, which was, you know, fun to snack on. But it took me a solid 2 more days to find a really fantastic small cheese shop selling the forefront of Ukrainian artisanal cheese, which is a thing now. It is actually a thing now, which is an entirely other line of speaking. But
yeah, that's another episode for sure.
Absolutely. People walk in and get the wrong impression. So what I would like to be able to do is always have some really fantastic American cheese on my shelf so I can say, well, you think that, but here, try a taste of this. Now, this was made raw milk in summer in the Driftless region of Wisconsin by Andy Hatch, or so on and so forth. I think that's a great way to start the dialogue about that, is by giving someone a mouthful.
I'm really interested to see how artisanal American cheeses get into Europe over time, like how they expand over time. It's something I've thought about off and on for the last decade or so. So I'm glad to hear your side of that.
Me too. You know, I wish we exported a few more of them. I think I'm optimistic that we'll get there. Again, with American Cheese Company doing its good work, that helps a lot. But, you know, there are so many fantastic American cheesemakers who I adore and who I love to talk about and whose cheeses I frankly miss at times, despite the incredible British stuff out here. So it would be nice to show them to the rest of the world.
Well, I did ask you to put together, though, a British pairing for us, or a pairing. I don't know if it's British. You're going to surprise me. So what do you got?
Oh, right. Well, I have two in front of me here. So the question is, do you want the one you can get in the U.S. or the one you can't, or a little bit of both?
Well, let's start with the one I can get in the U.S. And then, you know, we'll go out on a bang with the dreams, you know, the there hope one day. Yeah.
Oh, fabulous. I love it. So funnily enough, in front of me here, I've started with the cheese we talked about a little bit earlier in the episode, which is Spark and Ho Red Leicester, which is, for me, the last of its kind in that it's made in Southwest Leicestershire. It's raw milk. It's cloth bound. And it's artisanally produced by the Clark family. So this is a cheese I actually fell deeply in love with when I was in graduate school in the UK, nearly 10 years ago now. Jeez, wow.
Whew, you're aging yourself. There you go.
I know. This is horrific. But what I've done is I've taken a little bit of local sourdough from Landrace Bakery, just 45 seconds up the block from my shop, and toasted that and made the toasty treat with a little bit of a twist. So people are into toasties here. It's kind of like a grilled cheese sandwich, but usually open-faced. So I've grated some of this delicious cheese up. I've made a little bit of a base on the toast with some butter here, which is looking tempting, from Fen Farm. This is a raw milk salted butter. Spread a little bit of Fine Cheese Company onion chutney on there. So I got some melted Red Leicester right here. And on top of that, I've drizzled a little bit of my favorite thing, which is Marmite.
I was wondering if Marmite was going to come up in this episode. I'm glad you did it.
Absolutely. Hell yes. I love this stuff. You know, they're very smart. They had a campaign, which is you either love it or you hate it. And if you clicked on the I love it part of the website, it took you to the main part. If you clicked on I hate it, it took you to forums of people who hate Marmite. I adore it. Everyone has too much of it. It's so salty. You got to cut it with a little bit of butter or just drizzle. And this is my favorite cold weather food.
Trick.
Since it snowed yesterday, I wanted a cold weather toasty. And then on my other side in front of me, I can't get through an episode without going for a nice strong washed rind. So I have here one of my favorite things. So this is called St. Sarah. It is a raw Montbéliard cow's milk washed rind cheese. Starts out as a lactic set geotrichum cheese, so it's nice and brainy, and then the cheesemaker Julie Cheney washes it in just a simple brine, and it is stunning. I wish you could see it. It looks like it, basically if you took a Saint Marcellin in a little wood box instead of a pot and just washed it until it started to droop a little bit like an époisse. That's what's going on here, and it is personal sized. And so I have personally shoved a Fine Cheese Company quince toast for cheese into that because I think it's delightful, not just with sheep's milk cheese, but also with funky things, with that little bit of sweetness. And I'm going to use that as a vehicle to get this in my mouth. And since we're actually recording on Burns Night, I've got myself a lovely little glass of Glen Scotia whiskey to accompany that.
Oh, you lucky duck, you. And just to remind listeners, it's what time on your side? It's not as early as we all think for poor Nick, in case anyone was thinking.
It's 18:39 right now.
Oh, so it's true happy hour time, I think, out there.
True happy hour, 6:39.
Oh, yes. You lucky devil, you. See, this is another reason I can't wait till when everything is a little bit more normal in the world. I will travel and I will drink whiskey with you one day. And this is something very much to look forward to and eat fine cheeses. So
you come out here, I will host the heck out of you. We will go down into Somerset and see some amazing people. I love it down here, honestly. I love being in the rolling hills and the rain and the general kind of damp and old buildings and cobblestones. And it's not completely idyllic. You know, I live on the edge of a city, but I get that beautiful British countryside whenever the heck I want it, full of all of its magpies and pheasants and everything you want out of that. And I just adore it.
It sounds like a Christmas story almost. Like, I can't even... I'm very happy. Thank you, Nick, for coming on the show today. Thank you for putting together those pairings. I will have to look out for those things, and I will pay more attention for the Fine Cheese Company products, because I realize I haven't had them in a while, and I'd like to get back to them.
Again, we export all over the world. You'll find a majority in the U.S. You'll find a lot of our dry goods, so really fantastic crackers, some of which are branded actually with the exterior of the shop I work in, which is pretty great. Some really fantastic fruits for cheese, which is kind of like a membrillo, chutneys, and then we also export a lot of cheese. So those of you who work with World's Best, and you'll see a lot of stuff that we export there, a lot of really fantastic cheeses from British cheesemakers, and I hope you give them a try. And the next time we're all allowed to go down for fancy food, I'll certainly be down there to give you all a taste.
That's awesome. All right, Nick, thank you again. Listeners, you, as Nick just mentioned, you can find products at the specialty food stores around the U.S. You can find Nick at The Cheese Mason on Instagram. And you can find me at Kara Warren and Cutting the Curd at Cutting the Curd. Thank you all very much. And, Nick, one more thing. Sure, throw it out there.
Say, thank you for having me on. It is always delightful. This is my favorite podcast.
You're sweet.
It's a joy.
Oh, you're so sweet. Well, I love being cheesy together with everyone, so this is a good thing. Stay safe, everyone out there. Eat more cheese, and we'll talk soon.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.